This is the current federal tax developments for the week of January the 23rd, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE, a division of the LaScalzo Institute. This week, it's sometimes you just can't give them money. And this week, we're going to look at the following developments. First, we'll start out with discussion of relief that was granted by the IRS when a CPA firm accidentally failed to have the client file a Form 3115. The IRS loses a case on a passive activity issue when the tax court accepts the logic of a technical advice memorandum the IRS issued after the trial concluded to decide that based on that and based on the logic of that, that essentially the taxpayer was passive with regard to the activity in question. We'll also take a look at a second issue on the same case where the tax court applied the Rankmeyer case decision, but this time against the IRS to decide that that same taxpayer was not subject to self-employment tax on the flow-through income. We'll then move on to the fact that the IRS would not allow an employer to voluntarily pay money after the statute had closed when it made an error in their payroll tax reports, but we'll discover there's a reason for that. And finally, we'll give you a preview. The IRS has issued the proposed regulations dealing with the comprehensive partnership audit rules. We'll discuss some of the highlights of that, do a little bit this week. I'm planning to do a much deeper dive onto it later so that we can take a look at it next week because it's 277 pages long and it's going to take a little while to digest that one. So just wanted to let you know that we'll talk about the basics of how that gets started here, and then we'll go on to other things and hopefully give you a little more detail in the coming weeks. Well, it is coming to the end of the CPE season, but we do still have some updates that are going out there. And in fact, there are a set of four of them that's going to be going on with Butch Rogers in Ohio. This will be the federal tax update for industry coming up. And there are four dates scheduled. This has been a tradition in Ohio where we've done a tax update for business geared towards CPAs and industry. And that will start on Valentine's Day in Cincinnati, Ohio, or basically just outside Cincinnati in Fairfield. On February 16th, we'll be near Toledo, Ohio. So you'll have a session there. On the 17th in the Cleveland area. And on the 24th of February, the final session will be held live in Columbus and also will be webcast by the Ohio Society. So if you want to pick up, if you're in any of those areas or you just want to pick up the webcast, you can contact the Ohio Society of CPAs. They'll have information on how you want to sign up. This is going to deal with updates related to industry changes that we've had in the past year and up through the date of the presentation. Again, that's going to be coming up here in February from the 14th through the 24th. If you're around one of those four cities, check with the Ohio Society of CPAs for getting yourself signed up to get yourself started for updates for industry CPAs. Let's start with our first issue this week. And this actually was one that's an interesting case where it's illustrative of what's really an issue that we often have inside a CPA firm, that when we go to change how we do things, sometimes things fall through the cracks, and that's what happened here. This is Private Letter Ruling 2017-02021, issued on January the 13th. Now, this started out fairly simply. The taxpayer in question, in consultation with the taxpayer's CPA, because I really don't think the average client's going to come up with this idea on their own, took a look at what they were doing with regard to how they were handling prepaid insurance and decided that they could change their method of accounting to use a 12-month look-forward period and, in essence, accelerate their deduction for the insurance. But the problem that became here was, of course, that is a change of method. While the CPA suggested they do this, the client said, yeah, that makes sense. So they changed their method. The CPA in question and the firm prepared the 3115, which, of course, you have to file. You must have the IRS's permission to change the method, even in a case like this where the IRS allows you to change the method automatically. The CPA firm computed the Section 41A adjustment to make this change, and they made sure that, in fact, the taxpayer had recorded the item properly, and they put the proper deduction on there. but a couple of problems arose. First thing was the CPA firm in that year had decided to change over their system, so they're going to be doing a paperless system for handling their work papers. And most of us know that, you know, that transition when we did it, certainly it's wonderful when you're on the other side of it, but the year you do it, it's a little complicated and people get confused. Adding to the confusion, the CPA firm in question had acquired another CPA firm that same year. So we both had the problem of integrating two firms together, and we had the problem of converting over to a paperless system. Well, under the new system that the CPA firm worked under, there was a tracking system that they now adopted electronically, that if you had some special rule like an attachment for a 3115, there was a box you were supposed to check for that engagement that would flag the fact that there's an attachment to go in with the return beyond simply the return. In the confusion, apparently, the box never got checked. So even though they had a completed 3115, even though they had done all the work and they actually had the 41A adjustment on the return, the 3115 was never given to the client and was never sent in with the tax return, nor was a copy sent into what would have been Ogden at the time it should have been filed. Well, not surprisingly, in some ways, this didn't really get noticed right away because everything was still in the file. And so it all looked good until a few years later, the client in question, for unrelated reasons, went on to a new CPA firm. The new CPA firm, as part of their due diligence, noticed there had been this change of method in the past and asked for a copy of the 3115. While looking to get a copy of the filed 3115, the old CPA firm found out that, oops, it had never actually been sent in and never actually been submitted. Therefore, the client had no permission to change to the new method, and therefore, there was a problem now because without a permission to change, we were in trouble, shall we say. Well, the CPA firm, in discovering this, went ahead and prepared and apparently took through the process an application for a private letter ruling asking for the late election relief. In this case, the IRS granted that relief. Now, a couple of big things here as to why the relief is granted. Probably the major reason the relief is granted is because the taxpayer asked for relief prior to the service discovering relief was needed. So, you know, just playing ostrich and hope they'll never notice it. Well, okay, A, that's just not right. You're not really allowed to sign the return in that situation. But B, your problem is, while they probably won't catch it, if they ever do, you're just in big trouble and you're not likely to get a simple fix. In this case, the service granted the relief. Good news is, of course, that the client didn't have a problem. Everything got fixed. The bad news, though, of course, is it did require the payment of the PLR fee. And while we aren't told in this PLR who paid for it, we probably have a suspicion we know who had to pay for it. And also, there would be the professional time of shepherding it through the process. And again, probably the client didn't pay for that time, and probably the first CPA firm, which had failed to give the 3115 to the client to file, probably ended up having to eat those fees. But nevertheless, it is a good lesson in a couple of things here. First, remember, when you change your processes, the chances of errors are much higher because people aren't used to systems, and that's what happened in this case. Number two, it's really important to do your due diligence when you take on a new client. The second CPA firm in this case, in essence, ended up being scot-free and having no problems because they recognized the issue up front. Had they not discovered the problem on their due diligence, there's a decent risk that if things went wrong, the new CPA firm might have been subjected to potential liability on the theory that they should have caught it. Well, they figured out what was there. Third, as always, if you discover a situation like this, remember that the IRS in situations like this generally will grant relief if you ask them first. So it's important to remember to swallow your pride and tell them, yes, we'll file for the private letter ruling. And in this case, you got your private letter ruling. So that was actually a nice, basically nice result. Next up, we're going to actually consider this case for two different discussions here, but let's start the first discussion here on this case. The case in question is Hardy versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-16, issued on January 17th. The taxpayer in this case is a physician. He's a pediatric plastic surgeon, reconstructive plastic surgeon, and he performed his surgeries in local hospitals, and he did some in his office if they required only local anesthesia. Well, he discovered there was kind of a problem because getting time at the hospitals, because there are only so many operating rooms available in his area, he was located in Montana, and there just weren't a whole lot that could be used. There was a limited supply, and he couldn't get the dates or the times he really wanted to do all the surgeries. So he looked into opening his own surgical center. Well, he actually did a lot of work down that road, but then he kind of determined it'd be expensive and messy. And at the same time, he was approached by an organization that was starting up a surgical center and wanted to know if he wanted to be an investor. So he went ahead and invested in the surgical center. He had a 12.5% interest in the surgery center. If you're looking at the slides, unfortunately, I've got it wrong up there. It says 15. I left off the 12.5. So it is a 12.5% interest. Now, he got a K-1 every year from the surgical center. The K-1 showed flow-through income from a trader business, and it showed self-employment income on the K-1. In 2006 and 2007, his return was prepared showing this as material participation income. The tax professional who handled it indicated that he had looked at the K-1, noticed the self-employment income, and decided that that must mean that he materially participated in this, that he was active enough and he was doing things in the business. Now, it turns out that wasn't actually the fact. In 2008, after doing more study, it was determined that, wait, he really wasn't doing anything. What happened here was he did do surgeries at the surgery center, but he did them basically on the same terms as any physician in the area, or any surgeon in the area, would have been able to do surgeries at the center. The fact he was an owner made no difference. He didn't get any extra amount allocated to him because of the surgeries that he sent there. He simply used it. He had an investment interest in it. So the tax return took the position that he had a passive activity. Now, this is helpful because he did have other investments which drew up passive activity losses. So in 2008, 2009, the years that were before the tax court, he took the position it was a passive activity. Now, the IRS said, no, 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 no. He materially participates. And they actually tried two different arguments to say he materially participated. First, and their main argument was that by reporting it as materially participating in 2006 and 2007, that the taxpayer had effectively grouped the surgical center with his medical practice. And under the passive activity rules, once you group activities together, you're not going to be able to change the grouping unless there's a material change in circumstance. Just discovering that, in fact, you weren't doing anything at the surgery center, it would have qualified as passive had you not grouped it, would not have been a valid reason to ungroup. But the tax court said, wait a minute, there was no indication on the tax return that he had grouped this with his medical practice. And also, when we talked to the tax professional about why it had been reported as material participation, it was never referenced in any of his decisions that he thought it somehow got lumped in with the medical practice. So for that reason, the court said there had been no previous grouping. So IRS, you're wrong about the regrouping. The taxpayer is not trying to regroup. He's just trying to relabel. He's just trying to state that this activity really is a passive activity and not one he's materially participating in. And that's a question of fact. Well, the IRS said, okay, well, if that's right, nevertheless, realistically, under the regulations, you need to group in an appropriate economic unit. And they were stating that it's not an appropriate economic unit to leave the surgical center out away from his medical practice. I mean, he's a doctor and he's doing surgeries there. Well, the tax court said, IRS, I don't really think that's necessarily so. The IRS was trying to rely upon a regulation, an example found in Regulation 1.469 F2. But that regulation talks specifically about a doctor, doctors who had entered into a partnership to run a surgical center where they had done so to get around the 469 rules, and where they basically, you know, the surgical center was only used by the physicians that owned an interest in the partnership. The tax court said that's not really the facts here. Secondly, they said IRS, after trial, you issued a private letter rule or a technical advice memorandum, 2016-34-022, which, by the way, we've discussed on this program before, that looked at virtually identical facts and concluded there was no requirement to group a medical practice with this kind of surgical center where the doctor was solely an investor in the surgical center. So the tax court took the position that essentially, nope, the doctor did not materially participate. Now, there was one bad fact for the taxpayer in this case, and that was that since he had previously been treating this income as materially participation income, and it was six figures income in the six figure ranges, he had not been counting his passive income, so he had accumulated some significant passive loss carryovers. In 2008, when he took this as passive income, he reported those carryovers on his 2008 return and then took the deduction that year. The IRS challenged that, stating, well, if it really was passive in the past, there wouldn't have been a carryover coming into 2008. The tax court agreed with that position. Now, the tax court did note, though, that the taxpayers attempted to argue a doctrine of equitable recoupment should apply in this case, you know, in essence saying, to be fair, we should be able to catch it up because the IRS benefited from us not taking it as passive activity in the past. But the court found in this case that they had not raised this position in their tax court petition. They first raised it on brief, and it is a positive defense. The court found that they had raised it too late. So unfortunately, we do not know whether, in fact, equitable recoupment could have allowed the taxpayers to have claimed this loss. But as it was, the carryover losses basically disappeared under this structure. Now let's consider the second issue we want to consider on this case. This, again, the case is Hardy versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-16. And again, the opinion was released on January the 16th. Now we have a second issue. I wanted to break this out because I think both of these issues are important standalone issues. In this case, we went on now. We've got this surgical center again. We've got the physician who had the investment in there. And he performed some surgeries there, but the vast majority of his surgeries were performed either at his office or at hospitals or other places. So he did a minority of his surgeries at the surgery center. He did not actually participate in running the surgery center, did no management. He had the right to sit in on broad conferences, but he didn't do anything with day-to-day operating the surgery center. So he wasn't involved in any of those activities. The IRS said, well, nevertheless, this is, you know, he's doing surgeries at the surgery center, so the flow-through income must relate to self-employment income, and he owes self-employment tax. The tax court did not agree. And what's interesting about this case is the tax court went and grabbed the case of Rinkmeyer, Campbell, and Weaver. Those of you probably remember the Rinkmeyer case. The Rinkmeyer, Campbell, and Weaver case was a case from 2011 where the tax court looked at the question of whether or not these attorneys who were in a limited liability partnership could totally escape self-employment tax because they were LLP members. And in that case, the court said, well, you guys are service providers. You put no money into the operations. Therefore, clearly, this is not a return on capital. This is a return on your services. We believe what Congress meant in 1402A13, which is what excludes flow-through income to a limited partner from being taxed as self-employment income, was they didn't want people to be able to escape the tax if they really performed those services. So Rinkmeyer, they said, you guys need to pay the tax. In this case, the court said this is exact opposite. In this case, really, his main relationship with the operations of the surgical center was as an investor. And as an investor, this was a return on capital. So in this case, they said that with this interest, this LLC interest he held was actually equivalent to a limited partnership interest for purposes of federal tax law, and therefore none of the flow-through income was subject to C tax. The one issue we, of course, have here is what happens in the situation, which has not yet come before the court, if we have somebody who both performs services but also has a significant investment in capital. Do we end up splitting the two, or does one or the other of these positions as a service provider or as an investor dominate and force us to one or the other answers? Obviously, that's a question for a later day, but it is interesting to note that in this case, the court applied Rankmeyer, and they applied it in a way that the IRS probably didn't like. Next up, it's rare to see the government turn down money, but in this case, they did. This is AM 2017-001, a memorandum from the Chief Counsel's Office issued on January the 13th. In this case, the question came up, some employers had neglected to withhold FICA and Medicare taxes when non-qualified deferred comp was no longer subject to a substantial risk of forfeiture. Basically, it vested. Under the rules for payroll taxes applied to deferred comp, while deferred comp is not subject to income tax, non-qualified deferred comp, so long as it could be subject to the claims of creditors against the employer, it is nevertheless subject to payroll taxes as soon as there's no substantial risk of forfeiture. Well, this company neglected to pay that. And then we end up going a few years, and so we are past the statute of limitations for the IRS to assess tax against those years. But then the employer discovers this. Now, the problem is under the regulations that handle this, this is regulation 31.3121 V2-1D1II, that provides that if you don't take it into account when it vests, then every dollar will be subject to FICA and Medicare tax when paid. That's a bad result because generally somebody who has non-qualified deferred comp is an executive, and they vest in a year where they're over the FICA limit. So the only tax imposed is the Medicare tax. And secondly, it's on the present value of the payments in the future. So in fact, it's discounted back. And we pay a much smaller amount of tax, and we only pay Medicare tax. If it comes out when it's finally paid, then we are going to probably have no other earnings when it's finally paid out, when they're retired. Therefore, that's going to push them through FICA all the way. So we're going to have all the standard FICA tax plus the Medicare tax. And it's not going to be on that discounted value anymore, but all the deemed earnings up to the date it's paid are also going to be subject to FICA Medicare tax. So it's going to be a lot more costly. The taxpayers were asking to be able to, they realized you can't force us to pay this, but we're going to voluntarily pay it. And will you say that because of that, you'll agree that we don't owe FICA when we later pay these guys out in the future? And the national office told the agent in the field not to agree to that closing agreement. Rather, they said, the regulation provides treatment for when they fail to make the payment timely. And when the statute closed on changing that prior one, on the service being able to collect, then they just have to live with the fact that they're going to have to collect FICA on the full payout of the non-qualified deferred comp. Obviously, this is a bad result, and this is a result that might cause some liability for the company because the employees who are going to have this taken out may not be happy, and it may turn out that some additional compensation might be needed or requested to make up for the little fact that they're going to have to pay payroll taxes that they really shouldn't have had to pay. Finally, want to give you a little sneak peek on a future presentation. The IRS has issued proposed regulations for the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015 Comprehensive Partnership Audit Regime. These proposed regulations, REG 136118-15, were issued on January the 19th. Now, they're 277 pages long, and I've not had time to really go through them all in detail, but there are a few interesting things in here. One thing is the regulation makes it very clear the service is not going to expand the opt-out rules. So if you are hoping to be able to get an expanded opt-out where you might have a partner who is of an entity type that's not listed, can't we just get the credit shelter trust in here, or can't we get disregarded entities into this and allow a discarded entity partner not to kill it off? Don't bet on it. The IRS also effectively threatens to carefully examine those who opt out. So that's not exactly good news. They're saying they'll take a close look. And they actually even state that they plan to audit a significant number of those returns. I think that's more of a threat. But obviously, a lot of people concluded that the IRS prefers the other system and might audit the other partnerships. Service claims that won't be the case. And they take a very broad view about what part of partnerships operations this cover. Finally, they do make it clear that this covers only income tax issues. They can still open up an item on the partner, on the individual partners, for things like self-employment tax or the extra Medicare tax, all those things that will come outside of Chapter 1 of the Internal Revenue Code, that they can still, and they can use the audit here. Obviously, they got to be within the right time frames, but they use information they found in this audit of the partnership to then go after individual partners for that SE tax, etc. So it's not necessarily true you're going to get out of that. So be careful. We'll take a closer look at this here sometime in the future. Well, guess what? You may have noticed last Friday, we had a change of government. So that we have now a new administration to go with the new Congress we got at the beginning of the month of January. And we have, therefore, a lot of people thinking that we're going to be seeing some new tax developments. There's certainly been a lot of talk about comprehensive tax reform of some sort. As those reforms come, be sure to keep up with developments via your state CPA society and this broadcast here. Most likely, if we actually do get these developments, we will be shortly able to, both via us and your state society, we'll be looking at trying to develop some continuing education programs to explain what's happening. Keep your eyes open, listen here, and make sure, remember, your state society is going to be one of the first places that's going to be able to give you a real comprehensive look at whatever the new administration and the Congress comes up with this year. So check in. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January 23rd, 2017. Be sure to catch our regular updates online at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also find there a PDF with articles describing all developments we talked about this week. You can send questions and comments about this particular program to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me online at Twitter, on Twitter, should I say. My handle there is at Ed Zollers. Look forward to seeing you next week and talking to you about some of the new developments, and hopefully get time to get into the details of those partnership regs, plus other developments in the upcoming week.